Welcome to the Centre for Public Integrity's podcast, a podcast where we, Australia's leading democracy research institute, bring listeners with us as we peer under the bonnet of how our democracy works with key decision makers and policy designers. I'm Michael Barker, former federal court judge and a director at the centre. And today, I'm pleased to welcome Kate Chaney MP to the podcast. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you very much, Michael. It is a joy to be here.
Well, here we are. Backed by Eskimo Joe's drum kit in the West End of Fremantle, talking about democracy. Can you think of a better thing to do?
Oh, it's so cool. It's like many of my favourite things brought together.
Well, one of your favourite things, obviously, has been to be a politician, although you may tell us you're a reluctant politician. I'm not sure. For our listeners, remind them when you got elected and how that came about.
Well, I'd never been involved in politics at all and had a varied career through business and law and consulting and private sector and non-profit sector, and then was asked in 2022 by a community group if I'd consider running as an independent. And I told them I'd be really supportive if they found someone else. And then after a couple of weeks of thinking about it, decided that I was frustrated enough with the short-term thinking in politics to say yes. And it's been an amazing journey. It's been fascinating and frustrating and an absolute honour all at the same time.
Would it be fair to say that it was against the expectations of many that you won Curtin? It was a blue ribbon Liberal seat since I was a small child.
Yeah, it was definitely a bit of a long shot. When we launched, I felt sick about it before saying yes. And when I said yes, then I've not had a moment's regret since then, because it became apparent that there was something happening in our community and across Australia with more people just feeling like the two parties were not representing their values and looking for an alternative. And I think it's been very exciting to see that innovation in Australian democracy. And I'm thrilled to be able to be part of it.
You make a very interesting observation suggesting that the parties aren't representing their true values. So what were the values that you were representing to your electorate that, on the face of it, were the values they elected you for?
If I had to summarise it in one, it would be long-term thinking. But that was expressed in different ways. Integrity was a big part of that. And I think we see this terrible spiral where people think all politicians are crooked, therefore no one wants to become a politician because they've got such a bad reputation, and we end up, it's very difficult to lift that and break the decline. So integrity was one, rebuilding that trust in our institutions. Climate was another factor where I think the short-term thinking is really apparent. Economic reform, tax reform, but also compassion. And I do an exercise often when I do an event, and I say, give us one word to describe the country you want to live in. And every time I do it, the word kindness comes up. And I just felt like we were not seeing very much of that in the politics of the day, and we could afford to be appealing to the best in people and painting a positive vision of who we are and who we can be, rather than it all being about division and fear.
A number of so-called teal candidates, and you were included in that description, community candidates, were elected in the federal parliament at the last election, and you're all standing for election again. It must have felt like something of a tidal wave when you got to Canberra and met all these new colleagues, including all the so-called teals, not to mention a number of other crossbenchers, independents in the Senate and the like.
It's been fantastic, actually, and it was amazing to get there and meet a bunch of largely women who'd had an experience very like mine, who came from communities like mine. And we've all come from different walks of life. We've all had successful careers in the past in different areas, but were new to politics and were asked to run. And it's been very useful for me to have that reality check. I share an apartment with Monique Ryan and Allegra Spender from Melbourne and Sydney respectively, and all being new to the system, we come home and say, how about that thing that happened today? Does that seem normal to you? No, that was not normal. And just having that reality check, and also that group of women who I think are there for the right reasons and are genuinely interested in improving our democracy, it does give you it helps to give you courage, I think, and remind you why you're there.
With some other directors from the Centre for Public Integrity, I was in Parliament House in Canberra when the NAC, the National Anti-Corruption Commission legislation, was progressing through the Parliament, sitting up in the visitors' gallery and looking down. And the thing that struck me, I don't know why I knew this, was that the government members were on one side of the chamber and the opposition are over on the other side. The parties strategically placed their women so the electors can see them in the television grabs later. But all of the non-Labor and coalition people are all in another segment. Does it feel a bit odd sitting where you're all put there?
Well, it is true to our name as the crossbench. We sit in the crossfire, but the Speaker calls us Prefect's Corner because we play by the rules, we are civil and respectful, but also call out the bad behaviour when we see it. And I think that's a really important role to be played. And I've had people from both sides quietly say to me, it's been better since you guys have been there.
And I suspect having more women in the Parliament makes the boys behave better as well, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the culture in Parliament, you know, culture is a hard thing to change in any organisation or institution. And Question Time is probably the best example of a culture that is unique in Parliament, but completely normalised. If you've been there for a long time and grown up around it and been part of, you know, Young Liberal or Labor, it's normalised. But if you come in as an outsider, you look at it and think, this is setting an appalling example to the rest of the country. And I've been working on trying to improve Question Time. I've looked at research on how it can be improved, put that in front of the crossbench in both houses and say, which do you think are the top three improvements? And then written to the Speaker and both sides and given evidence at the Procedure Committee, because this is what people see about what we are. And I think the only way you can change culture really is to get in there and be different, and that starts to catch on. And I do think having more women there does change the atmosphere a bit.
Kate, being in a West Australian initially, but also having spent time living on the other side of the country and travelled as a judge, crisscrossing the country at times, I then run into local West Australian federal politicians on the planes coming home, and it always struck me that it's a really tough part of the job for those politicians who have to fly, get back to their electorates, have a range of responsibilities. How have you found it?
Look, it's not a lifestyle you'd wish on anyone. It definitely is worse in summer with the 3-hour time difference than in winter. It throws you out a bit, but ultimately I think you just have to toughen up about it and not think about it too much. Get on with it. I'm in Canberra for about 18 weeks a year, and then I leave home on a Sunday morning and get back on a Thursday night, usually pretty tired by the end of the week. But I'm lucky to have a really supportive husband, and my kids have been very supportive of me doing the job too. And I think that you just have to get on with it, really.
You don't just turn up for the 18 weeks. Well, you do, but you're also a member of a number of committees, aren't you? What are they, and how much time and how much interest do you have in them?
Oh, look, I love the committee work. I think that it is the best of Parliament in some ways. So I sit on three committees, Social Policy and Legal Affairs, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs, and the Electoral Matters Committee. And in all of those committees, you'll do an inquiry, get evidence from the public, both in written submissions and in oral evidence, and then work together to actually find a solution and make recommendations. So I think it's a great part of the parliamentary process. What I've seen, though, is that often those recommendations then just sit there. So I sat on the Social Policy and Legal Affairs Committee did an inquiry into gambling reform, And we had people from all across the political spectrum on that committee and came up with 31 recommendations, including one which was to phase out gambling ads like we did with tobacco 20 years ago. And that had unanimous support from committee members. It then gets handed over to the government, and there still has been no response to that 2 years later because the politics starts getting in the way. And the government, and I think probably the opposition too, don't want to annoy the TV stations who make a lot of money out of gambling ads. They don't want to annoy the gambling companies who make big political donations, or the sporting codes who benefit from it too. So I think the process is really good, but there should be more accountability on government to actually respond to those recommendations that, committees come up with.
You've only been in the Parliament this term, but taking your last observation about more accountability on the government, how does one achieve that? Has it occurred to you that there are some mechanisms?
Well, I think, you know, there are always better ways that it could be done. There is technically a requirement that committees, that the government respond to committee reports within 3 or 6 months, depending on the committee, but it's not, or it's not complied with. And I think having more independence, you know, more of a crossbench, it does allow you to bring these things into the national conversation so that there's at least political and media accountability, even if you can't actually nail someone to the wall and force them to give you a response. And so I think the media has a role to play, the crossbench has a role to play. It would be great if there were if there was a greater accountability for not responding to committee reports, but ultimately each side has to answer for the decisions they've made about which to listen to and which to ignore.
The traditional answer to the problem of governments not doing things that committees recommend is that, well, you'll have to answer for it at the next election, but that's not always enough, is it?
Well, it's not. I think there are lots of other issues that fall into that same category as well. And so the question is whether people will vote based on whether the government has ignored a committee report or not. It may not be a vote changer. But I certainly speak to a lot of people on the gambling example who are very disappointed that the government hasn't done more and do consider it to be a failure when there are those recommendations on the table. So I guess this is the messiness of our democracy and the imperfection. It just happens to be better than anything else we've come up with.
In those broad terms, what do you rate as the biggest challenge you've faced over this last term?
So I think going in as an independent with a view to making a difference to the declining trust we're seeing, which I think is largely driven through the two-party system. A challenge has been focusing on those first principles and why you're there and how you can change the system in the context of all the daily noise and the constant, short media cycle, the issue of the day, the wedges. It's very hard to really focus on that North Star and retain that sense of naivety in some ways and optimism, saying, well, how do we change this and make it better? It's very easy for people to say, well, the system's broken, but there's nothing I can do about it. But I have a genuine interest in improving it. And so focusing on those long-term key issues in the context of the media circus has probably been the biggest challenge.
But we'll come back to some of the long terms, but just in this term, what do you rate as your biggest win?
I mean, there have been various amendments to legislation or laws that have been passed that may not have been passed without pressure, but I actually think, and maybe I'm a bit of a democracy nerd, but I think probably the thing I'm proudest about is the way we've been doing representation differently on the ground. So just in trying to rebuild that relationship of trust with the electorate, we've held lots of policy-related events where people can come along, have a say, hear other perspectives, contribute collectively. Then we write that up and say, here is a curtain submission on the issue of aged care or NDIS or active transport or whatever the topic is. And if you don't have a party telling you what your platform has to be, you can genuinely listen to the community and that can inform your position. Also increasing those communication lines. So twice a month I'll have a community event. One's a general community catch-up, come and bring your issue, and another one is a Canberra debrief where I go and say this is what's happened in the last month and take questions and discuss that. And I think opening those channels of communication so people can see and understand how and why you're representing them, that feels to me like the biggest achievement in the long, hard process of rebuilding trust in our democracy.
And I'm assuming that some of these are people who may always have had an interest in politics and might be sort of political tragics even. But have you attracted other people who didn't get the two-party system, weren't attracted to it or felt alienated by it?
Absolutely. And that's the thing I love. Of the 900 volunteers who supported my campaign the first time round, most of them had never been involved in politics before. And that re-engaging people is what feels exciting about this movement. I mean, I met with some donors last night and one guy who'd made a donation, having seen something on social media, had never been involved in politics before. And I had a really interesting conversation with him about independence, and he was saying, I just can't believe that the parties just have to vote the way they're told, and we need people who can make independent decisions. And that's what excites me, is that there are a whole lot of people who see that they can actually be represented now, whereas in the two-party system it just was a bit of an impenetrable world that they didn't really want to get involved in.
Kate, in attendance in the old days when men used to do everything, to think everyone was a philosopher king, all wise and all capable and knew everything. And we now live in an age where we've got many philosopher queens or people believe people know everything. But having your groups get together, your people in your electorate to talk to you, to develop submissions, just highlights for me the fact that being in Parliament, being across policy, must be an enormous challenge. And as I understand it, when you were elected, the staffing allowance was cut almost immediately. I mean, how have you managed that? Where do you get informed from? Because this seems to me to undercut the way democracy should work.
Yeah, and I think the staffing cuts definitely presented a challenge. But what it has meant, to look at the silver lining, is that I've had to rely on my community a lot and therefore represent the views in my community. One of the lovely things about being an MP is people are really generous with their time. So it took me a while to realise if I need to know about an issue, I can literally call the best expert in the country and say, can you tell me about this? So I think part of the first year was building your phone-a-friend list and work out who are the trusted experts whose advice I can seek on these issues. And then also tap into, I mean, I'm very lucky, there's a lot of expertise in my electorate on some issues that are very relevant. And people have been very generous. We did a Curtin Pathway to Net Zero report, and for a year I had 50 volunteers in 5 working groups meeting fortnightly around the main areas of decarbonisation to come up with a plan for what it would look like for our community to decarbonise. And I had policy people and planners and landscape gardeners and architects and all sorts of expertise and lots of engineers coming and thrashing ideas out collaboratively to come up with what I think is a beautiful piece of community-driven work that you couldn't get if you're in the party system. You also couldn't get it if you gave it to a consultant to do. It genuinely reflects a range of views, and there is real wisdom within the community that I now have to tap into.
You mentioned earlier when I was asking about where the crossbenchers sit in the Parliament and how parliamentarians are behaving, and how you get a couple of surreptitious whispers to say they're pleased you are all there, things are a little bit better. More generally, on the question of cross-aisle dealings, being down in the reps, dealing with those up in the Senate, how does all that work? How's it worked for you? Is it an important part of being a independent community candidate from Western Australia?
So I've had dealings with the crossbench in the Senate, fewer dealings with senators from the major parties. The crossbench meets, both houses' crossbenches meet once a week when we're in Parliament, and we talk about upcoming government legislation, private members' business, upcoming events, not to convince each other, but more on the logistics. I've worked quite a lot with David Pocock in the Senate in a few different areas, and certainly on legislation, if there are amendments that have been proposed by the crossbench in the lower house, we'll often pass those on, but not been successful, we might pass those on to independent senators to feed into their negotiations in the Senate. So I think we work pretty constructively with not the whole Senate crossbench, but parts of that. Jackie Lambie, Tammy Tyrrell, David Pocock are probably the ones that I've had the most to do with.
The Centre for Public Integrity is interested and does a lot of research and advocacy in relation to a range of issues that affect good government in this country. One of the matters we pushed for very hard was the what's now known as the National Anti-Corruption Commission, the NAC. And I was one of those who was fortunate to, as I said earlier, to see the bill going through. What's your assessment of its operation at this point? Are you happy?
Look, I think it's early days, and there's still work to be done. And the crossbench proposed a range of amendments to the NAC legislation when it came through. And I think if some of those had been successful, it would have done wonders for building trust on issues like public hearings. Now, having said that, whenever there's a new institution, it takes a while for it to find its feet. And I still, you know, hold out hope that we will see it conducting some inquiries, hopefully in the public eye, and delivering some outcomes that build that trust. I think the robo-debt, the way that was handled was unfortunate and probably has set back the public credibility of the NAC. But I would like to point out that it was picked up by the Inspector General, which was, and having an Inspector General, was a crossbench amendment to that legislation. So, you know, the system might be a bit unwieldy, but at least there, you know, it has actually progressed slightly painfully. And I hope that, I think there are some amendments that could be made would give greater visibility, greater transparency, and therefore build more trust in the public. But I also think we need to be patient as well. And there is there's a bit of a problem when you say we need an independent body, but then if you don't like the decisions of the independent body, you know say it's the problem of the body. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. But if we had more transparency about that, I think it would really help.
Political finance, donations to political candidates, political parties, of course, has always been a big issue. In 1991-92, I was one of the council assisting the WA Inc. inquiry and wrote a draft section on political finance at the time. Western Australia's amended their laws. There's real-time disclosure and just about everything that anybody gives, a nickel or a dime, so to speak. But that hasn't quite yet happened at the federal sphere. Legislation was put through Parliament very recently. It appeared to be, in the description of some of the commentators, a stitch-up between the two major parties. And it doesn't come in to play at the upcoming election, which everyone says will happen on the 12th of April, Kate, but the next one following that. What's your take on it, and where do you stand on the political finance laws, the donation laws?
So I'm in danger of really banging on this topic, so I'll try and keep it brief. But I think this is deeply concerning, because even though political finance sounds really boring, ultimately it determines who gets into Parliament and in whose interests they're making decisions. So it underpins our ability to make good decisions on a whole lot of other issues. I sat on the Electoral Matters Committee and put up additional comments to that report because there were things that had come out of submissions from organisations like CPI and others that the major parties did not want to pick up in their majority report that were about improving the system and making sure we have political competition. So then I actually turned that into a couple of pieces of legislation that were introduced in both houses and had the full support of most of the crossbench. The government said its policy was real-time disclosure. Now, it could have passed that on any day of this parliament with support from the crossbench, but instead it held it back and said it was going to do that along with some other so-called electoral reforms. I can see we need donation caps. I can see that we don't want any individual to have too big an influence on our political outcomes. Spending caps are really hard to do because there are all these party advantages and incumbency advantages. And in my additional comments, I identified about 13 party advantages. And so if you're having a spending cap, the problem is it ends up favouring the status quo. And they've also added a whole lot of additional public funding. So they're saying we're getting the big money out of politics. What they're actually doing is making sure that the big money flows from taxpayers to the major parties, and you know, it will prevent future competition. And then with the spending caps, it's just full of crazy holes. Like there's an $800,000 spending cap in each electorate. But that doesn't count if you're advertising the party, not the individual. So an independent challenger could be outspent many times over if the party chooses to spend its $90 million in your electorate. So I think it's a huge problem. It was rushed through with no scrutiny. And most bills that make serious changes go to a committee and are considered, and often there are amendments afterwards. This was rushed through with no scrutiny at all in the House and then in the Senate in the last week, possibly the last week of Parliament in this term. And it deserves scrutiny. If we're changing who can get into politics or who can get into being a representative, we need to look at those rules very carefully. We don't let Coles and Woolies make the laws about supermarket competition, but here we've seen Liberal and Labor getting together to make the laws about who can compete with them.
The Centre for Public Integrity Directors made a statement about the lack of scrutiny. I don't think there is even a review clause that we look at how it's working in 3 or 5 years' time.
No, the major parties have no interest in there being any scrutiny on this going forward. There's been a declining share of vote to the major parties over the last generation. And I can't see anything that would change that trend. Rather than trying to win back votes with good policy, they're changing the rules to arrest that trend. And I think it's deeply concerning for our democracy.
Kate, you've used the expression, it's interesting the way you use it, about competition in politics. Listeners to this, people who are interested in politics even a little bit, have been aware of a competition, if they live in the country, between the Nationals and Labor, or if they live in the city between the Liberals and Labor, and that's pretty much been it. And most of the time, with a few historic exceptions, the National Party, the old Country Party, and the Liberals have been a coalition. And that's been the competition. And occasionally we've had independents coming along. The so-called Teals, the independents in Parliament, the crossbenchers, represent something different and new. And this concept of incumbency and the advantage of being an incumbent member of Parliament, to having been elected and being there and having a party behind you, giving those candidates who are standing again some extra advantages over the first-time entrant, or you as just having come in as an independent in Curtin. Can you explain to the listeners a little bit more about that, why that reduces competition?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I suppose so part of those are party advantages and part are incumbency advantages, and I now have some of those incumbency advantages. So I have a team and a communications budget So my name is out there already. I have an office and, you know, all the resources that go with that. If you're a new challenger, you don't have any of those things. And then party advantages, they can do national TV advertising, you know, national scale in terms of design, but also the deals they get with the TV or radio or whatever else. So there are those economies of scale. And ultimately, I suppose, I think, you know, representative democracy, it should be possible for communities to choose how they want to be represented. And at the moment, really, you choose off the menu. So coming in as a new challenger, it's pretty daunting to face these big party machines with their dirt units and their, you know, attack and their sophistication in how they approach that, and saying, well, how are we going to face that? How, you know, I don't know even how to find a lawyer who knows how to deal with, you know, making sure we're getting our compliance side right, let alone the polling and political strategy and all of that. So there are all these disadvantages. And I think for a long time I've felt like people have been holding their nose a bit and just picking A or B because that's what's available. But because we have preferential voting and compulsory voting in Australia, we do have this other thing that's possible, that you're not wasting your vote if you vote for someone who's not A or B, because your vote will still count. And everyone has to vote, so it doesn't. You're not getting elections decided only by the extremes. Most people are in the centre, and so if they can find a candidate that represents their values, they don't have to choose A or B. But the rules have to make that possible. Another big change that we've just seen is a huge increase in public funding. So the parties get, or candidates get, $3.50 per vote from how many votes they got at the last election, which then turns into a war chest for next time. Now, in this recent piece of legislation that's passed, that goes up to $5. And then also there's this admin funding, that every MP gets $30,000 in admin funding because of this. It's apparently so hard to disclose in real time. But the disclosure at a party level will happen centrally. And yet they get an extra $30,000 for every MP. So it's really a big slush fund that will fund the party activities.
I'm sure there's going to be a lot of analysis, particularly from political scientists and the like, and bodies like CPI, as to how this works in practice. Kate, we're getting close to the end of this podcast. A couple of questions to finish with. I'm intrigued. Have you been amazed, shocked, flabbergasted, pleased, excited about anything in particular that you'd never thought you would be confronted with as a politician?
I think I've had all of those emotions every day, Michael. It is a wild ride, and it's full of emotion too. Like you do have the opportunity to hear about issues that are affecting people's lives every day in Parliament, and it is an extraordinary, you know, privilege to be so close to hearing about what matters to people. But you have to approach it with some humour as well. You know, there are so many ridiculous parts of the job. You know, one minute you're getting briefed on national security and the next minute you're posing with a puppy for a photo. You know, it's got this sublime to the ridiculous feeling to it. I think
I'm assuming that the sublime is the national security.
That's right. Depends on the briefing, I think. But I think that the thing that keeps me going is I still feel optimism about it, and I still feel like democracy is pretty amazing and we have to protect it. It is fragile and precious, but it is worth protecting. And so the thing that gets me out of bed every day now is to think that as we're seeing the polarisation of democracies globally and the rise of the far right, in Australia, we have this unique opportunity because of preferential and compulsory voting to choose a different parliament and to have a parliament where there are a bunch of people there in the middle who are not thinking about whether they're going to become a minister or not, or, you know, winning government. They're just thinking about making the laws better and working constructively with either side. And that's a different way of making decisions. And despite the shouting from both sides saying it'll be chaos and uncertainty, I think it's a really exciting development in democracy. And then we can have a parliament that actually holds the government to account rather than being a waiting room for future ministers. The parliament can do its job as a legislature and make the laws better. And that's what I find exciting and inspiring about where we are now in our democratic journey, and how Australia can buck the trend of the slightly depressing trend of global democracies and say there's a new model here and we're going to take it on.
In what you've just been telling me, I think there's a number of answers to the last question, but what unfinished business is there that then presents itself at the next term of Parliament?
It is all unfinished business. I mean, at an institutional level, I think there's institutional reform that needs to happen. Truth in political advertising, I think, is a huge concern. It has to be regulated very carefully and conservatively, but I think there's a huge risk. If you can't believe what you see and hear, then the concept of informed votes is under question. So that's one thing I'd like to see. I think there needs to be work done on the electoral reform to understand the implications of it and turn it back into a level playing field. We've talked a little bit about NAC and the improvements that need to be made there to rebuild trust in our politicians. Also, I think there's work to be done on whistleblower protection to make sure that our system can work to hold itself to account. They're all institutional reforms. There's a lot of unfinished business on the policy front, and a lot of that comes down to a lack of long-term thinking on economic reform, on housing affordability, on climate. The list goes on. That is the substance of what our democracy should be talking about. Getting the institutional reform right means that we can then address those issues in a sensible, long-term, balanced way.
Kate Chaney MP, it's been delightful talking to you today about all of these issues. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael. I've had an absolute ball. Thank you.